The World is brought to you by Progressive, where customers who save by switching their home and car save nearly $800 on average. Quote at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who save with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
President Biden has made a lot of rapid changes to immigration policy. People impacted are taking it all in with a grain of salt.
Just as quickly as the feelings of hope come, that hope can be crushed.
Also today, South Pacific Islands have been a bright spot during the pandemic. It's easier to seal off remote islands. It does, however, come with a cost.
Tons of people have lost their jobs and people pushed into poverty and unable to sort of meet their basic needs.
And athletes are being asked to get vaccinated before next summer's Olympics. That has raised ethical questions.
For us athletes, we're going to be jumping the queue, and I guess it's how much we jump it by is the question.
I'm Marco Werman. All of that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thanks for joining us. President Biden has only been on the job for 8 days, but already a bunch of executive orders, many of them rolling back some of President Trump's signature policies on the environment, the military, and on immigration. That includes reversing a travel ban on Muslim-majority nations and a temporary pause on deportations. To get us up to speed with how these changes in immigration policies are going and what's coming next, let me turn to The World's immigration editor, Monica Campbell. So some news to begin with, Monica. We had expected the Biden administration to unveil a second round of executive orders on immigration this week, but now it's looking like that might not happen so quickly. What's going on?
Right. We were expecting the Biden administration to unveil more changes on immigration this week, unraveling more of what the Trump administration did on immigration. Now there are some delays. We're not sure for how long. It could be that the administration is trying to make these orders more airtight legally. We're just not sure. But what we are expecting soon is the unveiling of a task force that would reunite or try to reunite those families separated at the border during the Trump administration.
So some wait and see. Immigrant groups and advocates, of course, have been pushing for big changes to the immigration system for years. So 8 days now into the new administration, what are you hearing from your sources about how this rollout on immigration is going so far?
They're generally optimistic and hopeful about what the Biden administration is rolling out. You're hearing about we're going to give the administration some time. I spoke with Juliana Macedo Nascimento about this. She's with United We Dream, and that's one of the larger immigrant advocacy groups in the United States.
We don't give up on any of this, right? Like right now, we don't know the viability of the big Biden bill. There's only the framework, right? The talking points from the administration itself. We haven't seen language. Whatever we can get passed and however many people we can get help for, we will fight for that.
The court battles against everything that Biden is going to do on immigration are really clear. Just this week, we saw how a judge in Texas stopped Biden's temporary halt on certain deportations.
Right, I saw that. A judge in Texas, a Trump appointee, he temporarily blocked Biden's 100-day moratorium on deportation. So tell us a bit more about that. And are you expecting a lot of right-wing challenges to Biden's executive orders like this?
So you're right. A judge in Texas hit pause on Biden's temporary block on certain deportations. It's a 14-day suspension. It could go longer. It depends on the judge. And the pushback against this moratorium on deportations is coming from Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton. He's the one suing to stop this. And he says that Texas is suffering harm because the more undocumented immigrants in the state of Texas only increases the state's health care and education costs. For sure, we're going to see legal fights, challenges from the right at every turn.
For people who might be facing deportation, Monica, what have you heard from them about this back and forth?
I wanted to hear from people who could face deportation themselves. And I spoke with Julio Cesar Gameta. He's a young undocumented man in his 20s in Milwaukee. And he came to the U.S. from Mexico when he was a kid. And I'd asked him if he'd heard the news about this moratorium on deportation. He'd just heard about it. And this was his reaction.
I was feeling safe before with the moratorium being in place, and now I really don't know. Like, does this mean that at any moment now I can be separated from my family?
Julio has a couple of misdemeanors. He's very vulnerable to being picked up by ICE. And, you know, he's in Milwaukee, which is a kind of so-called sanctuary city, but he's in the state of Wisconsin, which is not. He's keeping his expectations in place about all of this.
Every dreamer or undocumented person knows this. Like, you know, with a new administration, there may be hopes, and that hope can be crushed.
Obviously understanding there that these things don't change overnight. Monica, as you continue to follow Biden's actions on immigration, what are you looking out for next?
Well, I was really struck by, you know, what we saw just this month, a large number of people, mostly coming from Honduras, wanting to enter the United States, you know, approach the U.S.-Mexico border, and how it was broken up. I was speaking to a woman in Honduras this week who's actually helping to reunite families separated at the border, and I was talking to her, and she's in rural Honduras, does a lot of traveling, you know, along roads that have been washed out by hurricanes. You know, these are parts of the world where people may not have a home to go back to. You know, maybe they set out to reach the United States earlier this month and they came back, but they'll probably try and regroup and go back again. And so I'm definitely interested in how the Biden administration is going to treat people who are arriving to the border and other parts of the United States, you know, tomorrow. I mean, we're hearing a lot of discussion about the 11 million undocumented people who are already in the United States, but people keep arriving, right? And so how is that going to be addressed? And it's unclear. It's really unclear what would happen if we saw a large group, you know, approach the border tomorrow.
The World's immigration editor, Monica Campbell, thank you for being on The Story, Monica.
You're welcome.
The islands of the South Pacific have largely avoided the ravages of the pandemic. It helps to begin with that islands are, by their very character, remote and easy to seal off. But the COVID success in the South Pacific has come with a great economic cost. As Ashley Westerman reports from Tahiti, the whole region depends heavily on tourism and commodity exports, and it's hurting.
Patricia Marchand runs a small boutique on the southern part of the island of Tahiti. She says hello in Tahitian as a customer stops in to buy a drink and browse the art, jewelry, and other knickknacks for sale. Sales Marchand desperately needs to make. The French Pacific Territory's number one economic driver, tourism, has been obliterated by COVID-19.
Before it was nice because we have a lot of cruise ships. They come and it's full, packed every time. And business was good, really good.
At the height of the tourist season in 2019, she says she'd make some $15,000 a month.
And now it's not even $1,000. Enough to pay the rent and electricity, and I can't afford to pay any workers.
Early last year, officials estimated French Polynesia would lose nearly $1.2 billion because of COVID. And while official economic numbers for 2020 aren't yet out, major shortfalls are expected throughout the Pacific. The World Bank estimates an average decline of nearly 6% in per capita growth, with declines as high as 20% in Fiji. That's where Alan Gorton runs the Paradise Taviuni Resort on the outer Fijian island of the same name.
Business is not good at all.
Gorton says they depended heavily on clients from the U.S. And at the height of tourist season in 2019, they were making roughly $98,000 a month. Whereas from March 22nd to the end of 2020, they only made some $22,000. Gorton says they've had to lay off nearly 90% of their staff, as well as diversify and stretch their resources to even stay open. Luckily, he says, the bank didn't require them to repay any loans through the end of the year.
But now from the 1st of January, they've requested interest-only payments, of which we can't do because we've put in all of our funds into the property for the last 10 months. So if they start to demand payments, then we can't hold on. It's gone.
Roland Raja is a lead economist at the Lowy Institute, a Sydney-based independent think tank. He says the Pacific is also suffering because people can't travel out of the region for work. The remittances they send back are another important part of the economies. And there's a deep drop in global demand for certain key commodities like oil and timber.
What that means is that tons of people have lost their jobs, tons of businesses have been forced to close down, and you know, people are therefore pushed into poverty and unable to meet their basic needs.
And while wealthier nations are expected to get their average household incomes back up by 2022, Raja says that likely won't happen in the Pacific until 2028.
So it's a much longer recovery process. It's got to do with the more severe impact, the inability to bail themselves out, but also the fact that their recovery is probably going to be much slower than the recovery elsewhere.
To help avoid this so-called lost decade, Raja says an additional $3.5 billion in aid would need to come from the international community and other Pacific partners. Some larger countries, the U.S., Australia, New Zealand, and even China and Taiwan, have already given millions in the form of economic packages, healthcare equipment, and personal protective equipment. But whether that level of aid will continue, Raja says,
I think that's much more uncertain, unfortunately.
The Federated States of Micronesia just got its first COVID-19 case earlier this month, a case that medical experts say is historical, so not actively infectious. President David W. Penuelo says his government was able to pass a stimulus package to help many hotels and restaurants stay open.
But tourism is not really a huge industry in our country. Our revenue source has always been fisheries revenues, and we didn't get any economic downturn in that area.
The self-governing nation shares a bilateral agreement with Washington, known as a Compact of Free Association, which gives them access to U.S. aid dollars and military defense, a relationship that Penuelo says came in handy when more than 1,000 Micronesians still lost their jobs due to the pandemic.
The CARES Act, it reached our country because of our close ties with the United States. And so those who have lost their jobs are also eligible for the pandemic unemployment assistance.
Micronesia has also begun receiving Moderna COVID-19 vaccines from the U.S. And while Penuelo expects this level of cooperation to continue under the new Biden administration, tough decisions still need to be made. Penuelo says their healthcare system can't handle an outbreak of COVID-19, and so they will not even consider fully reopening until all Micronesians are vaccinated. Back in French Polynesia, the government made a different decision. Last July, it became the first place in the Pacific to reopen to tourists without a quarantine requirement. Shop owner Patricia Marchand says she has mixed feelings about that.
It's better than nothing.
Do you think that was the right decision?
Well, yes and no, because the COVID went up, so...
According to Johns Hopkins University, French Polynesia has had 17,800 coronavirus cases and nearly 130 deaths. And still, Marchand says she's unsure her business can stay open. For The World, I'm Ashley Westerman in Tahiti, French Polynesia.
In Warsaw and other Polish cities last night, thousands of mostly women bundled up in the cold and took to the streets to protest a controversial new abortion law that just went into effect. Abortions will now only be permitted in the cases of rape, incest, or if the mother's life is at risk. Terminations of pregnancies in cases of fetal abnormalities are now illegal, even ones where there is no chance of survival at birth. Critics of the rule say it amounts to a near total ban on abortion. The new rules were decided in October by Poland's constitutional court. In the fall, it was met by massive protests, tens of thousands of people taking to the streets, the biggest protest in Poland, in fact, since 1989, when people rose up to topple communism. The protests this fall prompted Poland's government, which is led by the right-wing Law and Justice Party, to delay the ban's implementation. But in a sudden move yesterday, the rule was put into effect. Once again, protesters took to the streets. Demonstrator Gabriela Stepniak spoke to Reuters.
I want us to have our basic rights, the right to decide about our bodies, the right to decide what we want to do and if we want to bear children and in what circumstances to have children. I do not want to get pregnant one day and see my child die after birth. This thought horrifies me.
It's expected there will be more protests in Poland over this near total ban on abortions. If you want the latest global news with your morning cup of coffee, we can make that happen for you. Every weekday, our newsletter, Top of the World, brings you fresh ideas and details about the stories we're following. Sign up by heading to theworld.org/newsletters. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Talks between the U.S. and the Taliban have sputtered since a peace deal was signed last year. But the Taliban is talking to Iran. This week, a delegation from the Taliban met with Iranian officials. Niloufar Saki has been following these talks. She's a lecturer in international affairs at George Washington University. Niloufar, what are the Taliban doing in Iran right now? Is this something that's happened before?
I think the relationship was always there. It was sometimes good and sometimes bad. But I think this move was particularly had two objectives. First, it was to show the United States its influence in the region. Iran has struggled to compete for power in the region historically, even during last 21 years of U.S. Engagement and intervention in Afghanistan. Iran always tried to. The other was to show its commitment in the peace process. I think that was another, the second objective of this particular trip. And by showing and showcasing that, well, Iran has a good relationship or having relationship with allies and adversaries as the peace process is actually led by the United States.
Does the Taliban typically visit with government officials from neighboring countries? And why would they do it now?
Well, as you might know, that the process actually give a lot of recognition, the deal, the U.S. deal, it gave a lot of recognition to Taliban. So Taliban consider themselves as the future of future leadership of Afghanistan. And that's why they extend their relationship with these neighboring countries.
This week, the Taliban has reportedly been criticizing the U.S., saying it would fight any groups working as mercenaries on behalf of the U.S. I mean, the U.S. does employ private military contractors, but why is this being talked about this week? Did something spark this worry for the Taliban?
Well, both Taliban and Iran, they want U.S. troops withdrawn from Afghanistan. That's a shared interest of both these groups, I mean, Iranian government and the Taliban. So in the long term, they don't want U.S. presence in Afghanistan. And I think that connects them. That connects them to a common goal that they have in terms of their interest in Afghanistan overall.
How do you think the Biden administration plans to approach the Taliban? Is Biden just going to pick up where Donald Trump left things?
Well, in terms of Biden administration already announced that they will reassess February deal of the Taliban and the United States. Reassessment means the number of troops. Reassessment means the timeline of troops withdrawal, which is initially scheduled in May of 2021. So reassessment means how committed and how committed actually Taliban are on the peace process. Reassessment means a Taliban connection with the other insurgent or a terrorist group. So this all come under reassessment plan that Biden administration has, what I see it. And I would say that they might have an extension of troops withdrawal from May of 2021 to another 6 or 7 months. They might extend it to the troops withdrawal to the end of the year this year. And that's one thing that they might do. And the second thing, I think they will be very strict on the relationship of the Taliban with other insurgent groups. So it's kind of a vague situation at this point of time, and not clear what Biden administration is going to do until they will have a complete reassessment of the deal.
Niloufar Saki is a lecturer in international affairs at George Washington University. Thank you very much for your time, Niloufar.
Thank you. Thank you, Marco.
10 years after Tunisian protesters triggered the wave of Arab uprisings, more demonstrations now against the government. The parliament building in the capital, Tunis, has become heavily fortified, with riot police squaring off against demonstrators. That was Tuesday, the biggest rally since protests began earlier this month on the 10th anniversary of Tunisia's revolution. Tunisia is now considered the only democratic state in the Arab world. Still, a decade on, political paralysis and economic crisis in Tunisia have delayed the goals of the revolution at best, and for many have crushed the hopes for progress. Lamine Benghazi works for Lawyers Without Borders in Tunis. So this week saw the largest rally since those protests began earlier this month, Lamine. What is the situation today in Tunis?
Well, the situation is as tense as it was a couple of months ago. It just has culminated in this protest yesterday in front of the parliament. The police responded with sheer brutality to these social movements. We're talking about 1,500 people arrested in the span of 4 days, and any of them, we were talking about 30% minors among the people who were arrested during those days. Sheer brutality that we witnessed also in the very heavy amount of tear gas that was shot, footage of police people shooting tear gas inside the houses, people, bloggers and normal citizens arrested as well for publishing messages in support of these protests and charged with incitement of rebellion, civil disobedience. So all of that sort of sparked new revolutionary flames in Tunisia.
So there is clear suspicion of the government, but the protesters have demands. What are they? What are they demonstrating for?
You have to know that poverty rates are extremely high in Tunisia. In Sidi Bouzid, in Gasserine, which are the cradles of the revolution, we still have the highest poverty rates, almost 30% versus 6% in Tunis, the capital. Unemployment, especially among the youth, especially among the graduates, is still skyrocketing. Of course, you might imagine that the situation has been exacerbated by the COVID situation. We have also a deterioration of public services with heavy impacts on institutional building in Tunisia. You have to know that we have a constitution that was voted in 2014 that was celebrated as one of the most progressive constitutions around the Arab world. But the political class has failed at translating into laws and institutions.
Yeah, so 10 years after the revolution that unleashed the other uprisings across the Arab world and North Africa, proof in Tunisia that democracy is messy. How are Tunisians dealing with that reality? How are you dealing with it, Lamine?
I mean, it's very hard. It's very complicated because we have growing disenchantment towards public institutions. People do not believe in the parliament anymore. People are starting to doubt this democratic process. People are more and more leaning towards populist discourses, be it on the radical Islamist fringe or calling for the restoration of the old regime, as we're seeing with the increasing popularity of the PDL party, the party of Abir Moussi, who was an important figure of the Ben Ali regime.
Ben Ali, the president who was overthrown, yeah.
And it's very hard for us, for citizens who believe in democracy, NGOs, activists, to keep that revolutionary flame going on. Although the movements that we saw from the week of the 14th to the 25th of January and the people that we saw in front of the parliament yesterday is also proof that the revolutionary flame is still burning, especially among the youth.
Lamine Benghazi works for Lawyers Without Borders in Tunisia. He's been speaking with us from Tunis. Lamine, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
You're with The World. Who says housekeeping isn't a real job? A political party in India has a proposal that could change that. Step one, recognize that housework has value.
The best way sometimes to appreciate the value of such work is to put a price on it.
A salary for cooking, cleaning, and taking care of the kids. That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Less than 6 months until the Tokyo Olympics, with a lot of unknowns. This week, though, International Olympic Committee President Thomas Bach did make one thing clear.
We are not speculating of whether the games are taking place. We are working on how the games will take place.
In other words, how to keep people safe from the coronavirus. The IOC is encouraging all participating nations to vaccinate their athletes. That's raising logistical and ethical questions, though, even from the athletes. Here's The World's Bianca Hillier.
Rumors have been flying about if, how, and when Olympic athletes will receive the COVID-19 vaccine. The controversy started when some suggested that athletes would get priority access. IOC President Bach says that's not happening.
There is no blueprint for this, and we are learning every day. But we are not in favor of athletes jumping the queue.
President Bach emphasized that once healthcare professionals and vulnerable groups are taken care of, then athletes should be offered the shots. Many athletes agree with this stance, even though it jeopardizes their chance of competing. Three-time Paralympian Neil Fahey from the UK says he sees both sides of the coin.
Certainly, you know, you start to ask those moral questions of, well, if it was between yourself and an elderly relative, then who would you rather get the vaccine? It's quite a difficult one to answer.
Difficult, he explained, because people devote years of their lives to the games. And for some, Tokyo 2020 is their final chance to represent their country on the international stage. But then his mind goes to friends and family.
You know, I'd much rather see my parents get a vaccine before me because I'm far more worried about the potential health risks for them.
As far as when athletes will be offered the vaccine, IOC President Thomas Bach has asked the 206 National Olympic Committees to lead their own charge.
It is up to each government to decide about the vaccination, about access to vaccination in their respective countries.
Israel's Olympic Committee says it has already inoculated half of its athletes, while Denmark and Hungary say their delegations will get vaccinated in a couple of months. And in Belgium, the country's Olympic Committee has already asked its government to pledge 500 vaccines for Olympians and staff. Johan Bellmans, chief physician of the committee, told local media he doesn't see this as asking for preferential treatment.
Vragen zeker geen voorrang ten opzichte van de risicogroepen, dus de medisch zorgbehoevenden.
He says the intention is not to preempt healthcare workers and vulnerable groups, but we do want to protect our athletes. Obviously, we don't want our athletes to be at a competitive disadvantage. Meanwhile, other countries haven't even started administering the vaccine to essential workers or vulnerable groups, including the host country, Japan itself. Medical workers there are scheduled to get their first shots at the end of February. In the U.S., the CDC considers more than 60% of Americans to be essential workers or otherwise vulnerable to the virus, meaning healthy Olympic athletes have a long time to wait until it's their turn. Will it all happen in time for the Games? Vivian Reifberg spent more than 30 years figuring out operational challenges like this in the healthcare industry. She says it's possible.
The number of athletes coming from any one country is, on the one hand, a small number relative to the number of vaccines that could be going on.
A few hundred athletes, she says, isn't a lot compared to a country of millions. But on the other hand,
the distribution and availability of vaccines is very uneven around the world, and even within the wealthiest countries is not widespread.
Reifberg added that unless more vaccines are widely approved and available, adhering to the IOC's timeline will be a challenge. British Paralympian Neil Fahey says to him, the timeline doesn't sound feasible.
When you consider how many of the population would be ahead of me, in reality, if the point I would be offered the vaccine is so far down the line, it'd be long past the games have happened. So I think it's inevitable for us athletes, we're going to be jumping the queue to some degree. And I guess it's how much we jump it by is the question.
I asked the IOC that question. Once essential workers and others in vulnerable groups are vaccinated, will athletes then be first in line? Will they be prioritized over the non-vulnerable general public? Via email, they declined to comment. The IOC is expected to share more tactics to safeguard the Tokyo Olympics next week. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
And one more Olympic-related note to share. The IOC is upping its commitments in the fight against climate change. It's setting a target to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 45% by the end of the decade. IOC President Thomas Bach made the announcement yesterday.
In addition to reducing our emissions, we will offset more than 100% of our remaining carbon emissions.
The IOC is doing this through the Olympic Forest Project, combating desertification in Africa's Sahel region. Within 3 years, the IOC says it will actually be removing more carbon from the air than it emits. And we're not just talking wonky numbers here. The Olympics have a massive audience, and the IOC and host cities are using their bullhorn to show off what they can do. At next year's Winter Games in Beijing, all the venues are aiming to run on 100% renewable energy. Faster, higher, stronger, and now greener. So let's talk about how carbon offsets exactly work, like the one IOC President Thomas Bach mentioned. That's on the agenda in our weekly look at climate change solutions, The Big Fix.
We have come here to let you know that change is coming, whether you like it or not.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
What we do now and in the next few years will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
Going carbon neutral doesn't mean entirely halting all greenhouse gases. It means reducing emissions and then paying to capture and store the same amount of carbon you're still emitting. Over the next 2 weeks, we'll be looking at the problems and promise of purchasing carbon offsets. The world's Anna Kussmer explains what an offset is and some of their inherent problems.
The idea is sort of simple. An offset is paying someone to take carbon out of the atmosphere to offset the amount you're emitting. Usually this means conserving forests, paying to regrow trees that have already been cut, or protect a standing forest. It's a $5 billion plus dollar business that attracts companies from Microsoft to...
Disney is working to support fair trade coffee farmers through an innovative project in the Altomayo Forest in the Amazon region of northern Peru.
Disney invested in forest conservation to offset their cruise ship emissions. Cruise ships are incredibly polluting.
Lauren Gifford from the Metropolitan State University of Denver did her PhD research on Disney's offset projects in Peru. The project started in 2009 to get farmers to stop cutting down trees to plant coffee.
So part of that Disney money was meant to retrain folks, get them to like do more small scale sustainable agriculture so that they're not like moving when the soil was no longer fruitful.
Disney invested millions of dollars in its offset projects and markets itself as an eco-friendly company.
Taking a Disney cruise on a totally amazing ship, designed to minimize its impact on the environment.
Our commitment to protecting our planet comes to life every day around the world.
One way to do this is to invest in standing forests in places like Peru. This is exactly what Disney is doing in the Altomayo.
Offsets can seem like a win-win. Make companies look environmentally responsible and raise money for forest conservation. Their demand has gone up in recent years and is expected to go up even more to help polluters meet net zero emission promises. Last year, the UN launched a big effort to source more forest offsets to meet growing demand.
There are so many companies coming out there.
John Davis is with South Pole, an environmental consultancy company that specializes in offsets.
Not just companies, but also countries and governments that are committing to net zero carbon emissions by 2050, if not before.
The problem with offsets is that it's really hard to tell if they're actually reducing carbon emissions. When scrutinized, many projects fall short. Lauren Gifford found this to be the case with Disney's project in Peru.
There was a lot of violence erupting in the area.
The land was contested and many local people fought against the project.
And if you have that level of conflict, like your resources are not going to avoiding deforestation or improving the way a forest is managed.
A Bloomberg investigation last year found how much forest was actually saved was hard to gauge because Disney's estimates relied on murky math. And this gets to the wider pitfalls of offsets. There are two main ones, says Tim Searchinger, an offsets expert at Princeton University and the World Resources Institute. One, are you really saving the forest?
So if you pay somebody to protect a forest, how do you know that they weren't going to just protect that forest anyway?
Two, are you just moving deforestation somewhere else?
If you pay John to protect his forest over here, but you still have demand for food, does Jill then just go and clear some forest over there so you don't get an actual net gain?
And the protection needs to last for as long as a century to actually offset the emissions the forest is meant to. If these conditions can be met, offsets could help save a lot of forests, says Searchinger.
I think one of the cheaper ways of helping to solve climate change is basically in this space, if you really do it right. So I think this is a good space to be focused on.
But there are scant examples of what it means to do offsets right. Instead, there are dozens of examples of projects that fail, backfire, or lead to bad outcomes for local people, like Disney's work in Peru. Critics of offsets say they let polluters off the hook And the dynamic of rich countries paying poor ones leads to a dangerous power imbalance. Here's Lauren Gifford again.
There's a term in the scholarship called carbon colonialism.
Money from rich countries being invested in ones with fewer resources and power.
And then dictating to those folks who are hosting these projects how you need to maintain that land for 100 years. And that, again, is privileging the interests of polluters in how people, you know, exist in their space and manage their land.
Experts I talked to said rich countries investing in projects within their own borders could lessen the power imbalance between buyer and seller. And doing projects at a larger scale could help save more trees. Working in areas where fewer people use the forest could reduce conflict. And John Davis from South Pole says offsets should be used as a last resort.
With your unavoidable emissions, with those emissions you simply can't get rid of, come into the carbon offset market to purchase those.
Even experts who have been studying offsets for decades don't know whether they'll ever be a great solution, like Barbara Haya at the University of California, Berkeley.
I mean, some days I wake up and I'm like, we just need to throw offsets away because there's no way to regulate it because of that uncertainty and that subjectivity and all of the pressures.
She's seen a lot of plans on paper that just didn't work in practice.
And then some days I wake up and I'm like, no, we just need to tighten up the rules to really assure the buyers and the public that those credits are real.
By 2050, scientists say greenhouse gases will need to be sequestered at a massive scale to limit global warming to the safest levels. Conserving forests will be a big part of that. The question is how much offsets can actually help. For The World, I'm Anna Kussmer.
Next week on The Big Fix, Anna reports on a forest conservation project in Canada that could be a model for how to do offsets right. In just over a week, the Biden administration has changed a lot of environmental policies quickly. If you've got a question about how new American climate policies could impact the rest of the globe, email us at climate@theworld.org. Cleaning, cooking, taking care of children, work typically done in the home, often unpaid, and overwhelmingly around the world done by women. But a political party in the Indian state of Tamil Nadu is putting forward a bold proposal that could change that: pay for housework. Prabha Koteshwaran is following this closely. She's a professor of law and justice at King's College London. So this proposal comes from the Makkal Nidhi Mayam party in the state of Tamil Nadu. What is the party actually proposing, and are there any specifics about how it would get done?
I think the party didn't actually expect the level of discussion that this particular proposal of theirs has attracted. So when they were actually interviewed on national TV and asked about the specifics, they said that the details were being worked out. But it appears that they are not really thinking of salaries for housewives as a global payment or as a universal handout. They're really thinking about this as a need-based program targeted at the most vulnerable members of society.
You've done a lot of research looking at the legal precedent behind a proposal like this. You found that courts in India have at times put a monetary value on labor in the home. Tell us more about that and whether you think it provides an existing model for a proposal like this.
Absolutely. So the courts actually, like courts all around the world, were approached by husbands and children of women who had died in motor vehicles accidents. And when these cases came up before them and families were requesting compensation from insurance companies, courts initially awarded compensation for loss of consortium. They awarded compensation for loss of love and affection. But at some point, they realized that actually the household was suffering from a loss of services of the woman. And that is when the courts began to imagine this as an occupation of the housewife and then fixed a certain monthly payment for loss of services. So they played a very important role in recognizing the unpaid work of women and actually called on the state to begin to count women's unpaid work better. They called for reforms in family law and contract law and other areas of the law in order to recognize women's unpaid work.
So this recent history suggests to you that it's not inconceivable that this new proposal or some form of it could move forward.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, I think there's generally been some resistance to the proposal, particularly from feminists, and quite understandably so, because the assumption is that this really reinforces gendered stereotypes of women as really belonging only to the household. And I understand that this is deeply problematic. However, I also think that in a country like India, where gendered norms are so entrenched, the only way that you can even begin to reduce or redistribute unpaid work is by recognizing that it has some value. And the best way sometimes to appreciate the value of such work is to put a price on it.
Well, a lot of people hearing this will relate, because women do an enormous amount of unpaid work in the home all over the world. And due to the pandemic, in many cases, this imbalance is growing. How big of an impact could a salary for work done in the home have on women's economic advancement, on equality in India generally?
I think putting a price on women's work through wages will actually, you know, set boundaries to the kind of work that they're doing. It will likely improve women's economic bargaining power within marriage. And I think most importantly, it can have ripple effects across a range of work sectors involving feminized labor, including teaching, nursing, healthcare jobs, childcare jobs, and so on, which are often simply understood to be, you know, a natural extension of the work that women do within the household. So they're just perceived as being easy work. And therefore, these women are not treated as workers. They are not paid salaries. They're just given an honorarium, for instance, the healthcare workers in India. So I think this would actually be a shot in the arm for entire groups of paid female workers in feminized sectors to bargain for better wages and working conditions. I think most importantly, I'm hoping that this would really be a way of politicizing millions of women in India who are housewives and ultimately mobilize women. I think it's only by addressing unpaid work within marriage that we can really aim for all the other long-lasting programs of gender equality that we're so keen to achieve.
Prabha Koteshwaran is a professor of law and justice at King's College London. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Today, President Biden continued his cascade of executive orders. The headline that he's expanding health care is welcome news to many people, including 20-year-old Leticia Arcila in Atlanta. We met Arcila last year as part of our Every 30 Seconds project, following young Latino first-time voters. From WABE in Atlanta, Martha Dalton has this update.
When we first met Leticia last February, she was on crutches.
I tore a ligament in my knee.
She tripped and fell at work and went to an emergency room to get treated.
A lady with the billing kind of information came in. First thing she asked me was like, okay, well, do you have insurance? And I don't have insurance, so I obviously said no.
She had a job, but no health insurance.
She was like, okay, well, your bill is estimately $1,300-something.
She ended up paying a few hundred dollars out of pocket. Leticia initially supported Bernie Sanders for president because he promised to expand healthcare access. After Sanders dropped out, Leticia resigned herself to supporting Joe Biden. Now she feels optimistic about the future. And there's something else.
I just got insurance from my job, from working so much there. They gave me benefits, and I want to say that it has changed my life. Having health care has literally changed my life.
She has a different job now and says it's the first time she's had private insurance.
I have never had the ability to go to a chiropractor ever in my life. And I'm going like weekly. I'm going to a gastroenterologist. I'm doing all of this stuff. I'm going to go see a therapist. Like, I cannot believe how much one tiny amount of help can change so much.
And she says it's more than just being able to see a specialist when she needs to.
Even though I'm working a lot now and, you know, school is a lot, I don't feel as stressed as I did before. I feel like I can actually handle things going on.
Now she'd like to see the same thing happen for others, like her cousin, Brian Rico. He's 19 and, like Leticia, voted in his first presidential election for Joe Biden. Brian works two jobs but doesn't have insurance.
I don't really get covered for my job.
It sucks, right? It sucks.
So I would want something to, you know, at least act like a blanket in any case something happens.
The cousins are very close, and they share a lot of the same political beliefs.
I think that it's really hard also in the position that I was in a year ago and that, you know, Brian is currently in, and that thousands or millions of Americans also go through that are young and they have, you know, immigrant parents who, you know, only go to the hospital unless it's absolutely necessary or you're like losing an arm.
Leticia is hopeful that President Joe Biden with a Democratic Congress will be able to improve the healthcare system. Both cousins are encouraged by the fact that Biden has already signed dozens of executive orders on issues like immigration, pandemic relief, and climate change. Here's Brian again.
We expect him to really go out and do those things that he actually promised he would do. And for him to actually start putting out executive orders, showing that he actually will start doing change, really has me happy that maybe this year really is a year that people start realizing that this actual change is going to happen.
The whole family is counting on that change. Leticia's parents are saving money to buy a house. Meanwhile, a pending immigration case will determine if they receive U.S. residency.
Things are looking pretty good right now. Hopefully things stay good. I want to stay optimistic. I don't want to think negative about anything. You know, I just want to start the new year with a clean slate.
After a tough year, politically and personally, Leticia says they can all finally breathe. For The World, I'm Martha Dalton in Atlanta.
Martha Dalton joins me now from her home studio in Atlanta. Hi, Martha.
Hi, Marco.
So Leticia's story there really showed how checking off the healthcare box can lead to so many other positive outcomes. We also got to hear from her cousin Brian, also a first-time voter, also someone who had to deal with no healthcare. Tell us more about how that motivated people like Leticia and Brian and making the connection between their health and casting a ballot.
Right. Well, you can hear them both talking about how they're coming into adulthood. So they're kind of learning about the healthcare system and how everything works. Whereas before, you know, as younger people, their parents take care of everything. And you hear Leticia talking about how much life has changed for her since she got healthcare coverage through her job. But she clearly remembers what it was like, because it wasn't that long ago, to be in Brian's position. So she has that empathy for what it's like. That was a huge factor in both of them in terms of their vote.
You've told us in past updates that Leticia's parents were not eligible to vote. She's the first person to cast a ballot in the U.S. in her immediate family. Usually parents influence their kids. They set the example to vote, even sometimes whom to vote for. In Leticia's case, how did this play out?
Yeah, well, it's really interesting. I think in her family, it sort of worked the other way. She's actually ended up influencing her parents. Mm. And as you mentioned, her parents aren't eligible to vote. But she said since she's been involved in the voting process, and she's done a little bit of phone banking, things like that, but she's not really an activist. But she's become interested in politics and engaged. And she says, you know, my parents, they didn't used to sort of watch the news or anything like that. But she says, now my mom calls me at work, you know, saying, did you see this on the news? Did you see that on the news? It's kind of interesting. As you said, a lot of times parents influence their kids, but in this case, it's sort of been the other way around.
We also learned this year that not all Latino voters considered immigration as their main voting issue. But for Leticia and her cousin Brian, immigration and healthcare did seem to be top of mind. Did Leticia's parents' immigration status, now applying for residency, did that influence their vote? What did they tell you?
Definitely, definitely. For the two of them, immigration is an important issue. And we learned during the runoff elections in Georgia that even though immigration may not be sort of a top three voting issue for the majority of Latino voters, it's still important to many of them. So some local data showed that about 25% of Latino voters listed immigration as an important voting issue. So not the majority of voters, but it's still an important issue for some.
So you covered the Latino youth vote in Georgia beyond the general election, Martha, into the runoffs earlier this month in Georgia. For both elections there, how important was the youth vote?
Well, all of the campaigns here definitely targeted young voters, and the use of social media became more important during the pandemic, you know, as people weren't gathering in large groups. So we saw campaigns turning to sites like TikTok to get their messages out, and it seems to have had an effect. You know, about a quarter of voters in both elections were under the age of 40.
Yeah, that does feel like a turning point. Martha Dalton, a reporter at WABE in Atlanta and part of our Every 30 Seconds team. Martha, it was great to have you as part of this project over the past year. And thank you so much for bringing us Leticia Arcila's story. I really learned a lot.
It was my pleasure. Thanks, Marco.
And that brings us to the end of our hour today on the airwaves. You can always find us online, though, at theworld.org. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You stay safe, be strong, and have a great evening.
From PRX.